You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Everybody, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and today I'll be speaking now for the third time with Omar Imadi. Omar was on the first time to speak about a novel he had just published. He is a prolific novelist. The second time he came on, he is also a serious scholar of Islam, the Quran, etc. He came on to speak about a book he had written called Divine Pronouns that took a look at what pronouns are used in the Quran. And this time I've asked him to come on and speak about Syria. He is, in addition to being a novelist and a scholar of things Islamic, he is an expert on Syria, having had a long career in that area. After careers at the United Nations Development Program and New York Institute of Technology, he also joined the Center for Syrian Studies at the University of St. Andrews, where he was the deputy director of the center and the managing editor of the center's journal, Syria Studies, and a senior fellow as well. So he has been all over the news, radio, TV, magazines, speaking about Syria. And I've asked him to come on to speak about post-Assad Syria and opportunities and potential landmines in the future. So I'm really looking forward to it. I hope you will enjoy it. And of course, I hope you will subscribe and like and all those good things that let me keep doing this. So without further ado, Omar Imadi. Hello, everybody. Curiosity Invited, and my name again is David Bryan, and the other fellow on the screen right now is Omar Imadi, and he's been on the program. I hope people have watched it before. Once, as I said, to speak about a novel he had just published. He's published several, and the next time, fascinating conversation about a book he had written. Called Divine Pronouns, and it was about the use of pronouns and the meaning of the different use of pronouns in the Quran. But in addition to that, he has he's a wealth of knowledge about Syria. You were born in Syria, yes?
Yes, I was born in Damascus. Yes,
in Damascus. And when did you leave?
Well, that's a long story. I should start. David was just saying one thing. You know, when usually people talk about Syria, you may not be familiar with this, but there's always a thirst amongst at least some of the audience to know where this person actually stands on what was taking place up to the time that the Assad regime fell. And so in full disclosure, let me just say this. I left the last time I've been in Syria was in January 2012.
Yes.
And I, since then, I was a fellow at the Center for Syrian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. I still am.
Yes.
And I've been participating in a lot of interviews, several television channels, and written a lot about just how ruthless the Assad regime was, and including the use of chemical weapons against civilians and things of this type. So, and because of this, I was not able to attend my sister's funeral back in 2016, nor my father's funeral in Damascus in 2022. So this is where I'm coming from. So the third now to understand your speaker's position can be put aside and we can talk freely. Back to your question, I grew up, I was born in Damascus. My father's from Damascus. My mother's American from New York. My father met my mom in the 1950s at NYU. They were both studying there together. My father was getting his doctorate in economics. He was sent on a scholarship to study in the States. And they got married. They returned to Syria in 1960. And I was born in 1966 in Damascus. And we stayed in Syria up to 79. My father, who was a minister of economy. In fact, my father is the longest serving minister of economy in modern Syria, which is a story we will inevitably explore, because it somehow has a lot to do with my understanding of what was taking place in Syria. So my father's position changed to the head or the president of the Arab Fund for Economic and Social Development in Kuwait. We moved to Kuwait in 79, I was 13. I graduated from high school and I moved to the States. I was studied at McAllister College, then University of Pennsylvania, and then I got my doctorate in 1993, and I returned to Syria. And I joined the UN at the time in Syria, the UNDP, United Nations Development Program. I worked there up to 2004 when I joined a university, an American university in Jordan. But I would travel back and forth every weekend to Damascus, up to 2012, when I couldn't do it anymore, because what was taking place in Syria was just so tragic on so many levels. And that was the end of that. And then I eventually moved to the UK, where I joined the Center for Syrian Studies. So that's in short.
Yes. So Assad took over from his father, correct?
Right. So look, Syria became independent from the French mandate in 1946.
Right.
And beyond 1946, it was essentially more or less a democratic country. And this continued with various qualifications, exceptions that we don't need to be, therefore a detail of the more specific type of presentation. But in 1963, the Ba'ath, it's a political party, means that...
Yes.
The resurrection of the Arab nation took over by a coup. And really, the nightmare that we've been through in Syria began in 1963. So we're talking about 61 years of an extremely ideologically oppressive government. And Assad, the father, Hafez,
the father.
He was already important as a minister of defense, but he officially takes over as a president in 1970. So I was 4 years old, and continues until his death in 2000, when his son, Bashar, takes over and continues until he basically escapes Syria on the 8th of December last year. So yes.
Was there from your perspective, was there a reason? I don't mean legitimate necessarily, but was there any sort of understanding of why the need for the brutality that began in 1970 or 1963, depending upon how you're counting?
Right.
And continued all the way through till December 24.
Well, I guess the first thing we need to do is just to focus on understanding these types of systems. So, and it's somewhat dangerous to over-personalizing them. When we say Assad.
Yeah.
There is an Assad, right?
Yeah.
There was a person, but it's really a system. A system takes place that by its very nature is it's almost based on the premise of not tolerating any form of dissent and on criminalizing dissent. So if you do not agree with how things are being run, how you're not simply dissenting, you're a traitor, you deserve to be brutally crushed. This is the type of, and Syria wasn't alone. I mean, there were many countries in the region. I should say, in the world at the time.
Sure.
Actually inspired by the Soviet Union, you know, this approach towards, you know, over, you know, almost like micromanaging a country in an under an ideological framework. And there's always an enemy that you have to almost create so as to provide legitimacy for why you exist. So in this case, in the case of Syria, of course, Israel and the presence of Israel and all of that becomes, you know, it's not so much that they are genuinely interested in helping, say, Palestinians or others who may have been under some form of occupation, but rather it's specifically created. So, an oppressor needs an enemy so as to justify the type of oppression that is taking place. And so it's the nature of a system, really. It's not so much that there is an actual rationale. And actually, there wasn't really much opposition on the level. I mean, people were frightened. How would they oppose, you know, a regime of such type? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, you just mentioned Russia as an exemplar, but then at some point, Russia and Iran played roles in keeping the regime as it was. Am I correct in that?
Right. When now you're moving, you know, across time, possibly it's important to begin with 2011, because 2011 was an extremely important year. You know, we have to start with what is called the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring is a moment during which many countries suddenly, you know, it began in Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, many countries in the region, almost like popular uprisings. You know, they simply had enough with this type of system. And for a while, people somehow assumed that Syria would be immune to this, that for whatever reason, we will not witness the same type of movement in Syria. But they were wrong. And in March 2011, the Arab Spring arrived in Syria, so to speak. And it started beautifully, David. You know, these were peaceful demonstrations. There were Muslim and Christian. You know, in Syria, we have a mosaic of religions and sects. So we have Alawites, who are Muslims, on the coast. We have Druze in the south. We have Sunnis all over the country. We have Arabs. We have Kurds. And, of course, we have a beautiful spectrum of Christian denominations as well. So representatives of these various, you know, groups would demonstrate peacefully, simply asking for change, asking, you know, having slogans like, we want dignity, we want to be treated in a dignified way, we want, you know, a country that represents all of us. And they were, you know, these very demonstrations were absolutely, you know, totally crushed, you know, in a military fashion.
I remember that.
And this continued. And it was almost as though the regime aimed at radicalizing, you know, it hated the image of a peaceful demonstration because it embarrassed it. The regime was embarrassed vis-a-vis the world by such demonstrations. So it wanted radicalized fighters so as to say, look, you know, these are terrorists and we're fighting them. So it almost worked so hard to produce a radical response from the opposition, and it ultimately succeeded, because there's only so much people can take if you go after their villages and towns and their cities. At some point or another, they're going to attempt to respond in a, you know, in a similar manner. And that's when we move from what you might call the uprising to what appeared and what many analysts would describe as a civil war almost. You know, perhaps that term maybe, you know, not everyone would agree with, but effectively you know, the regime was fighting against various areas that have succeeded in liberating themselves from the regime. And it would crush them. It would use seizures, hunger. One of its favorite tools was what is called barrel bombs, you know, basically barrels full of explosives. And they would just, you know, be dropped indiscriminately over towns and cities. You know, there's a town nearby my home in Damascus, in Mezib. The town is called Daraya. It's a small town. Over 6,000 barrel bombs were thrown over Daraya. You know, and then, of course, it ultimately moved to using, in some instances, chemical weapons against certain areas, and things of this type. And then, going back to your question, yes, it received help from Iran through Hezbollah, which was stationed in Lebanon. What's ironic is that Hezbollah, until 2011, was popular to a certain extent in Syria because it was regarded as somehow a symbol of resistance against Israeli occupation and things of this type. Mm-hmm. But in 2011, it became an instrument of oppression because it sided with the regime and in oppressing the Syrian demonstrators. And of course, Russia provided the air support. So it was almost, you know, there was no way that anyone could really withstand this type of military onslaught. Yes.
And was there something that shifted that allowed that essentially chased the power center out of the country, right? Assad fell and escaped to Russia.
Right. Well, I mean, to understand this, you'd have to step back a bit. So for about 6 or 7 years, depending on where you start, 2019, 18, essentially the regime was victorious, more or less. Crushed the rebels, with the exception of an area in the north called Idlib, and Kurdish areas in the northeast. But it essentially defeated everyone it set out to defeat. And those who had participated, you know, whether it's soldiers in the army or, you know, the various tools that the regime used to achieve this so-called victory, now expected life to change. Now expected, well, you know, you made numerous promises, but all we see now is a very, very weak economy. Our salaries partly, you know, can, you know, they can't really, they're not enough for a week, let alone a month. It is said that soldiers' salary is around $17. And in addition to this, these very people had to witness multimillionaires who, you know, whenever there's a war of this type, there's, you know, there is always corruption, but corruption is multiplied. So they're watching, you know, and observing all of these very wealthy individuals live a very different lifestyle in the country. So the erosion was from within, and over this 6-7 years, because nothing was delivered. Simply, the rebels were crushed, and it was more oppressive than ever, more corrupt than ever. So when it came to the critical moment when this area in the north, when the rebels in the area of the north began marching south, something remarkable happened, which is that the army, Assad's army, the regime's army, refused to fight, essentially withdrew. It withdrew from Aleppo. And then by the time, so you have this, to visualize the map, so you have Aleppo, Hama, Homs, Damascus. So for them to capture Aleppo was it was almost like a surreal movie. It is incredible, especially since there was hardly a fight.
Mm-hmm.
Aleppo is the second major city after Damascus, often described as the economic capital of Syria. So they take over Aleppo and then they march south to Hama. Now in Hama, hypothetically, all what is left of the army gathers at Hama. There is somewhat of a fight, but it lasts a day or two and everything crumbles. And then we start seeing whatever is left of the army march south to Homs. And Homs is hardly any battle at all. And by the time that takes place, we're talking about 10 days. So imagine with me, 10 days within which the Syrian army eventually, you know, just disintegrates, refuses to fight. It's almost like the conviction of the Syrian soldier is that, you know, I'm not going to fight for this regime because I understand who I'm fighting for. I'm right. fighting for a specific family, for the wealthy and corrupt, and I'm not part of this equation. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the regime, or the, you know, the face of the regime leaves, it falls apart, and who's taken over, and what do they have to do, and what's going to happen next?
Right.
Well, yes, I know I'm asking the impossible, but that's okay.
These are the more complicated questions. Well, first of all, these rebels in the north were often described by the regime as, and by others, as part of a very radical Islamic group or groups that were at one point in Iraq fighting the what they regarded what as the American occupation of Iraq. And they move at some point after the uprising in 2011, they move into Syria. They create this enclave, you might call, or this territory in northern Syria near the Turkish border. Now, what the regime would not talk about, and what others would seldom explore, is that yes, they arrive very radicalized, but they evolve. They're now, you know, governing a small province, and they understand that there's a difference between what you say when you're fighting and you're trying to mobilize support and how you act when you're actually governing, you know, normal people in a certain area. So they and there's been several studies on this, how they become more moderate over time, the language changes, the way in which they're actually governing these people. And they do it again, according to several studies, in a very intelligent way. They actually managed to the economy of the area that they were governing up in the north was in many ways much better than the economy of Syria that was governed by the regime.
Mm-hmm.
So there are several intelligent steps that take place. Now, when they move south, one of the first things they emphasized by their leader, Ahmed al-Shadr, who was a designated terrorist at some point, and there was a $10 million award by the U.S. to, you know, for information that would lead to his capture. It has since been removed after they had met him in Syria recently. So he emphasizes very clearly that because you see now all these groups, Assad relied significantly on a specific group, the Alawites, from whom he belongs. So they say to everyone, we're not here to attack you. We will respect all the components of Syrian society. We don't want revenge. We simply want to get rid of this oppressive regime. So this language was comforting for many. And you know, when they enter into these cities, they're for the most part, you know, true to their word. there aren't you know, real acts of revenge. And you need to imagine that this is the regime that was attacking this area. It would bombard the area in the north. So there's a lot of grievances and there's a lot of anger.
Right.
Given all of that, they really act, and one must say this in full honesty, they act in a very gracious way. They move to the south. But there's still a lot of apprehension because in the final analysis, in the eyes of some, these people were at one point part of a radical Islamic group, and now they're taking over. So, you know, people are worried. Moderate Muslims are worried. Christians are worried. Others are worried. You know, they did an interview with their leader, Ahmed al-Sharaa, recently. And there was something really fascinating that he emphasized. They asked him, you know, directly, you know, you were a member of Al-Qaeda and you were in, you know, various types of groups. And he says, you know, I was a young man and I saw something that I regarded as, you know, a foreign country coming in and taking over another Muslim country. And I became radicalized by this. But then I evolved intellectually over time, and I have changed significantly since. And I am completely against terrorism and towards attacking, you know, innocent civilians. And I am for a Syria that is inclusive for all its different components. So, you know, the very fact that he can address this and talk about this, I thought was quite interesting. I think that this is one thing that is lost in terms of our analysis of what takes place in the areas of the Middle East. We fail to understand why is it that people become radicalized. And once they are, we lock them into that. We don't give them permission to evolve and change and to become something else. So I think we might be observing something quite interesting, you know, how a group that was radical at one moment is now, because he's consistently saying, you know, the revolution is over. We are now, we want to govern a country. And he says that revolutions are, they're strong when it comes to tearing something down, but they're very weak when it comes to building something. And we are now in the stage of building something, which is a very different stage. But he's the very capacity of this person to speak in this way is very comforting for someone like me. Of course, there people still point out that he may not completely control some of the members of the groups that were fighting and that they may be acting in certain ways, that things of this type. But up to this point, given how much grievances there were, given how much anger there was, we really are pleasantly surprised that we're not seeing, you know, very frequent acts of revenge or mobs going after towns or this type.
Does that make you, as a whole, hopeful about Syria's future, the possibilities for the future?
Right. You know, I was just, before speaking to you, I was watching this interview with the head of a political party in Lebanon. He's a Christian nationalist, and he was asked about Syria, and he said, you know, it is impossible to have a regime in Syria today that is worse than the one we had. So no matter, you know, what has happened, you know, we're definitely in a better place.
It's better.
It can't be, you know, it can't possibly come close to just how bad it was.
Yeah.
Yes. And you know, I don't know to what extent you want to get into this, David, but when I say this, what comes back to me is that my father was a minister of economy within, you know, he was selected by the father, Hafez, I said, in 1971 to be minister of economy, and he remained to 79, and he was back in 85 and continued to be a minister to 2000. And my father and I would often have conversations about this, because even my father was not a member of a political party. Had studied in the States. He regarded himself as a technocrat, and he just really belongs to this category of what you might call as reformers. Reformers is a very difficult category, and I don't have the sensibility for it. You know, I left Syria, but a reformer under an oppressive regime is someone who's willing to, you know, almost walk into a very dark space and try consistently to, you know, almost turn on, light up a candle, or maybe two, or maybe three, within a very dark, oppressive space. And it takes a lot of talent for this. And my father wasn't the only one. There are several individuals that I knew personally. For example, Abdullah Dardari, who was a deputy prime minister for economic affairs, who is now the head of the UNDP, our bureau. Many others, they agreed to almost sign a silent treaty with the regime. Like, look, we know we there are many areas we can't touch. We know, you know, you're probably using us some way or another, but allow us some space to do something for these people. Allow us to something to this effect. And I wrote, you know, I wrote a biography of my father, and I often emphasize in it that I didn't write this book to celebrate my father's life. I love my father, and I respect my father, and I believe he was a very principled person. But it was always difficult for me to put together how someone who's so principled, so honest, you know, dedicated and loved his country, could somehow work within a regime like this and for so long. And of course, he had options. I mean, he didn't have to. He was well educated, but he truly believed that the country shouldn't be abandoned to the oppressors. That it is almost easier to be a revolutionary, because a revolutionary, you know, it's black and white, it's clear. You know, you know where you stand. But to actually work within and try to do something from within. And it reminded me, there's a professor named David Lubin, who writes about working within evil regimes and the fine line between attempting to do something helpful and being complicit somehow in what is taking place.
Sure.
And he points out two lawyers that work in Nazi Germany under the Nazi regime, who, and it can be historically, you know, demonstrated, who are capable of saving a lot of lives by the very fact that they actually held positions within this, again, evil regime. And so he goes on, you know, trying to explore at what point, you know, must one leave, and at one point one can still justify their presence in something like this. Yes.
Yeah. Did he ever find himself at odds with the regime, or he always managed
to? He was consistently at odds. I mean, my memories of him, you know, as the son of a minister, I should have been, you know, spoiled, and, you know, I mean, as a child, at least as a teenager, proud. You know, the very opposite existed in our home. You know, we were constantly afraid because my father was constantly afraid. So we soaked it up from him. He consistently acted like he doesn't know what they're going to do next to him, and would talk like this.
Yeah.
So we, rather than feeling privileged, we felt endangered. We felt like something wrong at any point take place, and, you know, and when it does, there's no recourse. There's nothing, no one, you can't reach out to anyone to protect you, because, you know, when they crush brutally, and they're not accountable to anyone.
Right. So given the events, well, given the arc of what you have seen, sometimes firsthand, but what do you imagine two things. What steps does the current leadership need to continue to take, and will it result in a prosperous, responsible Syria in, you know, a Syria in good relations with its neighbors and the rest of the world?
Right. Well, that's one of the first things that they emphasize, you know, because Syria was under sanctions, the regime, you know, wants money. It wants to continue its lifestyle. It wants to provide, you know, financial benefits to those that protect it. So they started exporting, manufacturing and exporting Captagon, right? Which is in essence a drug. And they would send it, you know, it was crazy, David, because this is a state-sponsored drug, you know, campaign, if you will. And so they would use, for example, baby powder cans, and they would place, you know, these Captagon pills inside of them. They would put them in, they would have, for example, some type of machinery, and, you know, they would place the pills with in ways that are almost impossible to find. And they had all these innovative ways. They would even use drones, you know, towards Jordan, you know, and to drop, you know, these drugs. So at the very least, things like this have either, you know, completely stopped, or, you know, 99% of them have stopped. So this was actually a very healthy and positive development. In terms of, you know, where this is going, you see, you're taught over time, and at my age, to become, you know, cautious in terms of what you expect. So, as I said, this is definitely a step in the positive direction. I hope that, you know, people in some, you know, over 80% of the population are under the poverty line. One of the first things that needs to be addressed now is just alleviating people's suffering. You know, just, you know, empowering people in an economic manner, and providing them with means by which they can feed their families and live, you know, a dignified life. So all of this is positive. For them not to live in fear, for, you know, to live in a manner where they don't feel like, you know, they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, things of this type. Now, in terms of, you know, larger questions, you can't impose a political sensibility on a population that is not ready, in its majority at least, to absorb it. In other words, the idea of having a system by which, you know, a certain group is allowed a term, and, you know, it can govern, and then if you like the way they wish they govern, you can change them, or you can keep them or change them, things of this type. This type of approach to governance, to political power, is not, you know, I mean, there are, of course, many who advocate it, but there's still this tendency towards having political systems that somehow rule by force of some type of religious or ideological, agency or power. And as long as this particular inclination is there, I don't think it's wise to impose something on people that, you know, they have to be thirsty enough for it. You know, ironically, the country that supported the rebels the most is Turkey. Turkey, for example, has one of the most secular constitutions in the world today. I mean, it's possibly more secular than the Constitution of the United States. It's a very secular constitution. Nevertheless, even within very secular constitution, you respect the will of the people. The people chose an Islamist Erdogan party to rule.
Yes.
And so having a constitution that allows, you know, people to choose and then to decide against or for, it does not mean that you are incapable of choosing a group that you think may have some type of religious program or something of this type. You elect whoever you want. But right. Until now, there's this sensibility that we want the way we see things to be reflected in the Constitution, in the leaders, etc. And that almost inevitably means that some groups are going to be marginalized, because clearly not everyone is going to see it that way. And therein lies, you know, the problem. I'm still optimistic. I think, you know, it just needs time. One of the things that, you know, people haven't been given the opportunity and chance to explore political horizons. You know, they've lived under dictatorship for various forms and types for 61 years. So, right. Yeah.
And you know, my knowledge of this area is woefully inadequate. But are there countries reaching out in a big way to help Syria economically, in whatever ways it feels like it needs help? Are there, and you know, who are those countries?
Right.
And do you trust
America sent his Undersecretary of State, Barbara Leaf, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
She visited Syria. She met with the leader of Syria, effectively, Ahmed Shara. She eased the sanctions, because the sanctions were so severe that even humanitarian aid would be difficult to deliver. So they eased the sanctions. Now, Europe is now beginning to also ease the sanctions. A lot of countries in the region, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and of course Turkey, are providing, and Qatar, are providing various types of assistance. There are some countries in the region that are a bit nervous. They're not quite sure, you know, who are these people, what kind of country they're going to create, what will it mean to us?
Yeah.
Will they somehow inspire our own citizens to be radicalized? Yeah. You know, there are questions of this type. But yes, it's already changing. It's already the Syrian pound vis-a-vis the dollar has already increased in value. Things of this type. Of course, you know, you destroy the country over, you know, 12, 13 years. You know, and building always takes longer than destruction.
Yes, building takes longer than destroying.
Rebuild, yes.
And do you have hopes of returning at least for a visit?
Well, finally I can, which is incredible. I mean, I can finally, you know, I want to go to Damascus. I want to visit my father's grave, my sister's grave. I want to, you know, visit my home. There are some favorite spots for me in Damascus, the Umayyad Mosque, the Grand Mosque of Damascus, which was once the Cathedral of John, which was once the Temple of Jupiter, which was once the Temple of Hadad, you know, a place that has been designated, you know, for sacred activity for thousands of years. It is also believed that the second coming of Jesus will take place in this spot. You know, it's a beautiful place, and you can just sit in the courtyard at sunset and watch the pigeons fly. You know, you have all these memories. And so, of course, yes, my mother is visiting me presently, but I'm already planning, you know, my return. Absolutely. Well, I'd love to.
That's lovely, actually. Well, I hope you get to get there sooner than later.
Yes. So I'll send you pictures.
Absolutely. I expect them.
Yes.
Well, Omar, I want to thank you for, actually, you, I entered this conversation mostly with trepidation, and I leave a little more hopeful, which is thank you. So thank you for that.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, you know, like that political figure from Lebanon said, you know, it has to be positive, because what was so bleak and so dark and so yeah. You know, you can talk for hours about just how you know, the nature of oppression that had taken place. So yes, we are definitely in a better moment. We're hopeful for the future. There are things that need to be resolved and need to be addressed, but at the very least, we got rid of that, you know, nightmare.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, thank you so much, and as always, thank you for being willing to spend time. And I know that this is not necessarily the conversations you most want to have in your life these days, but that I really appreciate you.
No, not at all. Thank you so much for having me again, David. It's always a pleasure to speak to you. And I must say that, you know, I did an interview not too long ago, and it was far more difficult than this because your mere presence, you know, makes me relax in a certain way, and I can just flow.
There we go.
So,
good.
Thank you again.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.